Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neuroscience Research Podcast. Today's April 3rd, 2025, and we are talking with Lorena Sailesis.
That's right.
Say it again.
Sailesis.
I'm so sorry. Lorena is assistant professor in the Department of Biophysics at the Center for Alzheimer's and Neurodegenerative Diseases at UT Southwestern Medical School. Mm-hmm. Lorena's lab works on amyloid deposition diseases, including but not restricted to the neurodegenerative diseases that we all know about, like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases. And she's especially focused on the structure of the amyloid-forming molecules and the structural features that lead to amyloid formation. And she uses really powerful biophysical techniques for getting extremely high-resolution, three-dimensional information about the native structure of the proteins involved. So hi, Lorena, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Chris Gamblin. Chris is our local amyloid structure enthusiast. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing, Charlie?
And I'm your host, Charlie Wilson. So Lorena, neuroscientists are familiar with A-beta and tau amyloid deposits in the brain in Alzheimer's disease, alpha-synuclein deposits in Parkinson's disease, and effort to relate those to the etiology of the disease, mm-hmm. the controversies that are associated with all of that stuff, and their roles in the diseases. And I think it is a little less appreciated by neuroscientists that there are lots of other amyloid diseases that affect a lot of other organs. And some of those also affect the brain, mm-hmm. but in a less dramatic way. And could you start by just sort of telling us what amyloid
is?
What is amyloid?
What is amyloid?
And tell us about amyloid diseases in a general way.
So I would say the definition of amyloid, it's been quite linked to the clinical side of it. And I think the definition, it's, if you talk to pathologists, for example, right, they will tell you, well, amyloid is some accumulation that you see on a stain, like a slide, right, and histological slide, and then you can stain it with specific dyes, and those are Congo red, or those are the thioflavin S. And the reason why these dyes actually bind to these structures is because these amyloids are made of fibrillar structures and assemblies that are very rich in beta strands, this secondary structure of proteins that is made of beta strands. So amyloids by definition is an assembly of proteins that has a very defined interdigitation between all the side chains of the residues of the proteins, that it's forming thousands of layers of the same protein, just elongating into a fibril. And because of the type of structure that they have, they can bind these dyes that are how, you know, they're even nowadays stained with and used in pathology labs to diagnose patients.
And the dyes don't care what the actual molecular species is. They're just interested in finding these aggregations of beta.
That's for the, in the case of thioflavin T, yes. In the case of Congo red, I believe as well. But not all the amyloids bind thioflavin T or S equally well. Like, for example, we have examples in our lab in where even coming from the same type of protein, and we were talking about polymorphism, right, in the fibrils before, even fibrils that are made of the same protein could bind thioflavin or Congo red differently. And it's because of the type of structure that they have internally.
And we've actually seen that the filament length can change the amount of how some of these things tie, how some of these things bind. Like it binds differently either to the ends or to the middle or things like that. So understanding exactly how these things work is, we're not there yet.
So we know, we can make a little list of some of the molecules that can form amyloid, like alpha-synuclein would be on the list, and tau. Mm-hmm. Can we make a list of ones that will never form amyloids?
That's an interesting question.
Because I'm just trying to kind of focus in on what is the particular molecular
signature
characteristic that they all have that make them dangerous in that regard?
And that's a fair question. I mean, I would say, and there are some people thinking that every protein has the potential to form amyloid fibrils under the right conditions. It's the same as crystallography. You can crystallize any protein if you force it enough, right? It's just about finding the right conditions for that particular protein to crystallize. I mean, there are many arguments against that, by the way. I'm not saying that that's true. But with the amyloid field, I think it's more or less the same. It's like every protein under the, you know, the best or under the right conditions could form these amyloid fibrils. Now, the reason why they can do that is because there are parts of the proteins that have this tendency to bind to each other. Because these fibrils are made of the same thing repeated over and over and over again. They're binding to each other in a very ordered way, right? So for the protein to bind to itself, it has to have a part of the protein that likes to bind itself, right? That it has this propensity to, you know, bind with each other. Normally, the evolution is wise, right? And normally, these parts of the proteins are not exposed. They're not exposed to the media. They're not exposed to the outside. So the same type of protein is not going to be able to find itself in that particular region. But there are some proteins that have the kind of the propensity to unfold a little bit now, or because of a mutation, because of some particular factors, that aging related factors that we don't know, because of lack of quality control in the cell, because it's overwhelmed with other things, because you have an infection that is going on and the cell is occupied with other things, and now these proteins go out of hand. But this unfolding now leads to the exposure of this segment that can stick to each other. And now if you have enough concentration, then you form these fibrils. So normally to make a list of proteins that are never gonna form an amyloid, I don't think we can, because they could, in theory, all do that. Another thing is that these proteins that form amyloids, and what actually differentiates them from the ones that don't, is the number of these regions that can bind to each other. Like normally proteins that tend to be involved in amyloid formation, they have more than one of these, they call it aggregation prone segments or aggregation prone regions, which is just a part of the protein that is very sticky. It's just like to stick to each other. If you have several of those, the probability of you sticking to it, you know, to yourself, it's higher. So I think that's the difference between the ones that have the tendency to form amyloids and the ones that don't have the tendency, is the exposure or not of those segments, how they are exposed in the structure, and the number of them. So I don't know. I can't make that list.
I see. So it's not really something special about the molecule. It's more like something special happened that caused this unfolding event at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't explain to me why. So if a alpha-synuclein molecule mm-hmm. unfolds a little bit so that now it would stick with another one, mm-hmm. if the other one hasn't unfolded, it won't stick. So the unfolding event can't just be a one-time thing, could it? I mean, seeding.
Seeding
idea
option
is that one of them that's unfolded is going to cause somehow the others to stick to it or to unfold themselves?
So that's one potential option. Another one is that when you have a system that is already overwhelmed, probably the unfolding is not an intrinsic problem, is more like an environment problem. Like, let's say that you have the cell is overwhelmed and then you have a number of molecules of alpha-synuclein in there. The unfolding is going to probably happen to more than one molecule, you know, especially if it's crowded, you know, and the cell is just going little nuts, right? And then you just have a number of alpha-synuclein there. They're not going to fold in the same way, but they might be unstable in the same way, right? That's one. Once you have a little fibril, we call it nuclei, right? Well, once we have these nuclei, then they can trap new molecules that are now soluble and incorporate into the fibril in a very efficient way, because it's kind of like a catalysis, right? It's like catalyzing these incorporation of the soluble alpha-synuclein. So those are two potential options. I don't know if it's yet clear how that happens though.
And so for prions, they call it template-assisted folding.
Yep.
And so it kind of uses itself as a scaffold to interact with the wild-type protein, the normally folded one, and it makes one really favorable interaction, which then encourages the next one. And then that one encourages the next one. And it's thought that they can actually, through these accumulation of these interactions, make the normal cellular protein unfold.
Yep.
They're prying them open.
It's priming. So, and this happens actually very often with proteins, amyloid precursor proteins that are not entirely structured, that they have some portion of the protein that is not completely structured. And then that maybe has something that is sticky already. So let's say that you have, and coming back to the sticky places, right? Like these sticky prone regions. If you have five of them, right? And normally four of them are not exposed. They are forming some structure. But then you have a pathogenic fold in some other molecule. And now that one has the right sticky places outside. As he was saying before, is like you can literally drug, like the first binding event can make the changes in the structure of this one that is fully folded and natively folded to unfold and start aggregating with itself. So it's a templated mechanism.
And alpha-synuclein and tau may be potentially kind of more susceptible to this because they have, as far as we know, pretty extended unfolded regions to begin with.
That's right.
And so they're kind of amorphous, they're flopping around, and so those types of cellular events may be at a lower threshold for some of these proteins. And synucleins may, even though I don't think we completely understand what synucleins do, they may like to interact with one another and kind of helping vesicles fuse and things like that. There's some evidence that tau molecules may like to associate with each other on the surface of the microtubules. And so you're just tweaking the system enough that it goes left instead of right.
And so there
are some things that I think it's easier for them. But everything may have the potential to form amyloid, but maybe not in a biologically useful time frame because the wild type form is just so difficult to bring apart. You know, by the time that happens, the protein's already been degraded and taken away.
So what's the worst thing that they do to cells? I mean, they're... some of them are outside the cell. There's some depositions are outside. Some are inside the cell. Inside the cell ones are kind of easy to view as bad because they're inside the cell. They're going to tear up the inside of the cell or something, disrupt it. But how about the outside of the cell ones? What do they do?
I'm going to let you talk about amyloid beta. But in my case, in the case of systemic amyloid diseases, this is actually easier to understand for the case of transthyretin. So ATTR amyloidosis is caused by the deposition of transthyretin. Transthyretin is in the blood. It's a transporter in the blood. It's secreted in the liver. In the liver, and then it, you know, deposits in different organs. In the heart, which is one of the organs that is most affected, it's a very, very good example of mechanical toxicity. What they call mechanical toxicity is just these fibrils are infiltrating between cells, myocytes, cardiomyocytes, and because of the cardiomyocytes, they need to have certain flexibility. They need to have this, I mean, they are pumping machines, right? If you have something that is quite solid, that is quite rigid, that is not degradable, that it's between the cells, that infiltration by itself causes mechanical interference with the function of the heart. Then eventually that leads to cells not functioning the way that they need, dying, and then creating this creating these very thick walls that are just super stiff, that can't pump anymore. That's for the case of the heart. Also another option is that the cells need to talk to each other, right? And when you have something in between that is just covering the, you know, all the extracellular matrix, now they can't talk to each other as efficiently, and then that can interfere with the function of the cell. In the case of the brain, I don't know if you want to talk about amyloid beta, but there is another hypothesis that it's the toxic oligomer hypothesis, in where not the fibril itself, not the big plaque itself, but rather small pieces of it that they, I mean, many studies have shown that if you add those to culture, right, like culture cells, they are toxic to cells, right? The cells end up dying. How that happens, there are many ways that people have talked about and have proposed. One of them is just creating membrane disruption, that, you know, like disrupting the membranes. Another one is more like a receptor-mediated toxicity, in where you just have some receptors binding to the oligomers, and then you have a cascade that end up being toxic to the cells. So there's a number of options. I would say that the presence of an amyloid plaque in between your neurons doesn't sound like a fun thing to have in the brain anyway. So the mechanism is yet to be...
The brain is just packed with stuff. I mean, it's really no space for anything
so
in between the neurons. And so something grows in between the neurons.
It pushes, yeah.
In the oligomeric form, you know, the idea is, you know, the interior of these things are pretty hydrophobic. And so around the outside, they're more polar, which if you wanted to design something to mess up a membrane, that's kind of what it would look like.
Yeah.
And so even when they're outside the cell, so there's evidence to suggest that they don't have that hard of a time getting inside the cell.
Uh-huh.
And once they're there, there are lots of membranes that they can mess with. Mitochondria is a big one. And as soon as you do that, you release reactive oxygen species, lots of oxidative stress, which can then go attack, you know, DNA, carbohydrates, lipids, everything. And so things just kind of start going crazy. But the cells have developed ways to combat that. So you activate ER-assisted degradation pathways, and you have the unfolded protein response. And but since these things are so tightly packed, they're hard to take apart, and they persist. And so you have this kind of like chronic unfolded protein response, and it never goes away, and it just overwhelms the cells. So the idea would be the formation of, like, maybe plaques, maybe neurofibrillary tangles, maybe Lewy bodies, other things like that. Are the cells' attempt to take this toxic stuff and shove it in the corner and protect themselves for as long as possible?
So what's the strategy? What's your strategy for thinking about it? So it sounds like I could make a wild guess based on what you do, that that understanding the protein and the protein structure and how that controls interactions would illuminate the process of amyloid formation and would tell us what to do about it. So why don't you tell us something about how you study
this, how we go about this. Well, in our lab, we have two main lines of investigation or lines of research. One that is highly based on structural biology. So I'm a structural biologist by training. I love structures. The students in my lab, they know that every time that they want to make me happy, they would show me something that is related to structure. So that is the way to get to my heart. But the way that we go about this is that we want to understand how these proteins are assembling, or they're assembled to form these fibrils, because just by understanding the formation of these big amyloid fibrils, we could design things to detect them. We can design things to degrade them. We can also understand the process of how a protein that is in theory functional and natively structured, how that converts into something that now is pathogenic. Now we can play with that just to see whether we can understand how these structures interact with the cells and stuff like that. So the atomic information or the structural information that we get from these amyloids is highly impactful and highly informative. So to get the structure of these fibrils, to get this information from these fibrils, we used two things. One is we base our research on samples from patients. And this is something that I think it's quite important to us. And we also have access to those. So that's also, something that happens to be like that. The second thing that we use is a very big microscope that is called cryo-electron microscope. And it uses vitrified samples to get images of the fibrils that we extract from patients. So we extract the fibrils from patients. We just have organs from autopsies or explanted organs from liver transplantations, heart transplantations. We get those fibrils, we put them on a grid, we send them to the microscope, and then we collect thousands of images. And then with those thousands of images, we can process the data and get the 3D reconstruction of how the fibrils look like at atomic resolution or near atomic resolution, right? Now, the second big line of investigation that we have in the lab is that now we translate that information into clinical tools. And one of the things that we've done in the past few years is to develop detection tools for amyloid fibrils. And we have found that these proteins can actually aggregate in the blood before even they infiltrate into the organs. And with these detectors of fibrils that are structure-based, we can use them for detecting these aggregates that are in circulation. And that's, it's a great invention and a great technology to study biology of the disease as well.
So what can you, if you have atomic resolution imaging of the protein, what does it tell you about the amyloid, the aggregation process, or what molecules will and what won't aggregate, or that I'm interested in the kind of prying open process where one molecule pries the other one open to get access to that sticky part.
I give you an example, and there are many examples like that. The more structures that you get, the more you learn, obviously. The more structures from the same protein you get, the more you learn about the process of aggregation of that protein. But there's one example that I have from a patient with ALK2 amyloidosis. It's a different type of systemic amyloid disease, very rare. It usually affects Hispanics and people from Middle Eastern. Is usually affecting the kidneys, right? So that's kind of like what affects the most. When we got this structure, we found that in this structure, there's 3 disulfide bonds. These 3 disulfide bonds are actually present in the native structure of the protein that aggregates. But the direction of the bond is different from the direction that you see in the native structure. So that tells you already that the native structure to become the toxic structure has to unfold dramatically.
Disulfide bonds are pretty strong. They are in the laboratory, they're destroyed by very harsh treatments.
Exactly. So it's not like our manipulation is going to break them apart and then it's going to come back into the fibril. Is that these disulfide bonds likely never got apart. So you have to unfold the thing. The disulfide bonds are going to be retained. They're going to remain in the same place. But now you need to change the direction of the protein. Let's say that this is the disulfide bond. You have it like this. Now it goes like this.
You've rotated around.
Rotate around the bond. So that tells you that the folding that you have in the native structure has to come apart enough for this rotation to happen. Because another option is that, well, if the disulfide bonds are not there, right? Well, you just, you have some the unfolding doesn't have to be so dramatic. or if they are there but the direction is the same, well, you say, well, there's some correlation, structural correlation from the native to the final structure. But this one is not. This one is like this. So you really have to open the structure, retaining the disulfide bonds, but opening the structure. So that's something that you can learn from that. Another thing is, like, for example, the same structure, we see that the entire protein, it's forming the core of the fibril. Normally, these fibrils are made of a core. That core is the one that is super, it's super tight, right? And then you have some additional residues, additional parts of the proteins that they call the fuzzy coat around the fibril that you don't get to know the structure of because it's disorder. So it's just like it's floppy, right? In this particular example, the entire sequence of the protein, the entire thing, it's incorporated into the core. There's no fuzzy coat. There's no fuzzy coat. That's also another important information about the aggregation of this protein. There are many. I can go on and on.
Some of these diseases are genetic, and so there must be a change in the primary structure of the protein that makes it more likely
to form
amyloid. Is that true? And can you pinpoint those changes and understand how
yes,
they work?
Yes, that was kind of like the way that people have thought about this for a long time. But
as always, a prelude to being told that it doesn't work, right?
No, I'm not. What I want to say is that I'm not sure anymore. Uh-huh. And the reason why I'm not sure anymore is that, for example, with ATTR amyloidosis, there are 200 mutations known that could be associated with amyloid diseases. I'm going to talk about two variants. One is the wild type, and one is the V122I. Doesn't matter. But let's call it X, all right? Wild type and X. Wild type and X have the same level of stability in vitro, the same structure if you crystallize it and you do, you know, you create a crystal of this protein, you get X-ray structure of this, it's the exact same. No variations, no nothing. The onset of disease is the same for both wild type and X, right? But the severity is different. So is it the aggregation pathway, or is the seeding, or is the infiltration, or is the something else? I'm not sure.
And if I could just jump in, because
absolutely,
you look at V to I. I saw several of the other ones were V to M.
Yeah,
those are really conservative changes.
They are
in terms of size and shape and hydrophobicity and things like that.
V to I, V to M.
Valine to isoleucine.
Oh, okay.
Valine to methionine.
Okay.
Size, shape, hydrophobicity. They're pretty conservative. They're not that different. And that's the thing that always bugs me, because there are several of those in tau.
Yeah.
And like a really bad one is V337M. And it's so subtle, but it's like dominant. I mean, it's like if you inherit this, you're pretty much going to get frontotemporal dementia. And so how does such a minor change have such a huge impact? And we're hoping that these approaches may take us closer to understanding, because we just really, really don't know right now. But for tau and some of these other ones, it's just really hard to replicate that. That's why I love your work, you know, in patients. Yeah. It's a great approach, because we don't have to stimulate it or reproduce it. We go and, you know, get that information where it actually happened. And I think that's the amazing power of a lot of the things that you do.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Well, great. That's very informative, at least for me. And so I really appreciate you, Marina, and Chris, for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
This has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.